These are the sounds and voices of 1966, a year of politics.
You did it! And what you've done makes this a great day for us and for the people of Michigan.
A year of controversy.
Ain't no question about it. We just got to organize and stop being ashamed and afraid to tell the man what's been on our mind for 400 years. Because black power is scaring the hell out of them and we ain't even organized yet.
A year of disagreement.
I think it's perfectly safe to say that this is the first work stoppage of college teachers to enforce contract demands of a certified bargaining agent in the history of the United States.
Of violence.
It was a crime of the century. It's one of the worst crimes I've ever seen since I've been a coroner in this county in that 6 years.
And of war.
We're getting a lot of casualties. I need help. I got two elements cut off.
These are the events of our time and of our place. Those happenings that each of us, for our own reasons, remember. This is an electronic diary of 1 year, 1966. WKNR News presents the sounds and voices of 1966 as they were gathered and reported by the WKNR News staff. This is Philip Nye. Nearly a decade ago, an unknown author in a little-known book wrote, "Either America is the hope of the world, or it is nothing." Perhaps at no time in history have those words held such meaning. Vietnam, the pivotal point of international and national argumentation. As 1 year ended and another began, there was a holiday truce in that undeclared war. The truce gave hope. Hope that perhaps the conflict would move from the jungle battlefields to the conference table. That spark of hope was soon extinguished.
So on this Monday morning in Vietnam, at my direction, after complete and thorough consultation and agreement with the government of South Vietnam, United States aircraft have resumed action in North Vietnam.
January had not ended when the decision was made to again send U.S. bombers north near Hanoi. At home, the battle was between the hawks and doves, and there were no party lines. Among those demanding withdrawal, Democratic Senators Fulbright and Morse. Others said we should fight to win.
To retreat and get out would be deemed a confession that we are a paper tiger.
Minority Leader Senator Everett Dirksen. The most vocal critic of the administration's Vietnam policy, Oregon's Wayne Morse. WKNR News recorded this exchange between the senator and General Maxwell Taylor during a Foreign Affairs Committee hearing.
I happen to hold to the point of view that it isn't going to be too long before the American people, as a people, will repudiate our war in Southeast Asia.
That, of course, is good news to Hanoi, Senator.
I know that that's the smear artist that you militarists give to those of us that have honest differences of opinion with you, but I don't intend to get down in the gutter with you and engage in that kind of debate, General. I'm simply saying that, in my judgment, the President of the United States is already losing the people of this country by the million in connection with his war in Southeast Asia. All I'm asking is, if the people decide that this war should be stopped in Southeast Asia, are you going to take the position that's weakness on the home front in a democracy?
I would feel that our people were badly misguided and did not understand the consequences of such a disaster.
Well, we agree on one thing, that they can be badly misguided, and you and the President, in my judgment, have been misguiding them for a long time in this war.
The great debate continued. Senator Fulbright coined a phrase, credibility gap, accusing the Johnson administration of failing to fully inform the public. Michigan's Gerald Ford led the GOP in picking up the call.
There are those in this administration who appear to believe that half a truth is better than none. We disagree. Where the American people at home are concerned, we must have the whole truth.
Later, at a House Un-American Activities Committee hearing, 50 persons were arrested as they vocally protested both the war and the draft. Marches and sit-ins were common. At Detroit's campus marshes at mid-year, our WKNR microphones there, as those protesting and those heckling the protesters made their opinions known.
End the war in Vietnam! Bring the troops home! End the war in Vietnam! Bring the troops home!
End the war in Vietnam! Bring the troops home!
Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids can you kill today? Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids can you kill today?
Bombing started again yesterday in Vietnam, and the bombing reminded us that we move closer and closer and further into Vietnam and closer to perhaps world war, or at least war in Southeast Asia, which these people are very much concerned with, as all people should be.
Well, I think all these people are traitors to our country.
Well, Vietnam will be ended only when every American soldier is withdrawn from Vietnamese soil.
Again in 66, it was common at colleges to blast the draft. It happened at Ann Arbor, at East Lansing, and most other campuses where the young faced military service. Late in December, a Detroit Episcopal minister, Reverend David Gracie, conducted a school on the draft, or how to beat it. WKNR newsman Ed Mullen questioned Reverend Gracie.
Why hold a conference like this at all? The reason that we felt that we had to do something of this nature was that we had found ourselves as individual churchmen and as members of religious bodies having been tremendously critical of the conduct and the aims of the war in Vietnam. We've branded it an immoral war.
While some at home attended makeshift classrooms on the art of conscientious objecting, the Vietnam War created heroes every day. Among them, Captain Bill Carpenter, former West Point football star who called for napalm strikes on his own company's position to fight back on Russian communists. Captain Carpenter said it was all in a day's work.
They started getting in amongst us, and I just called the airstrike in. That was the only place I could put it where I thought it was effective.
Late in June, a 17-year-old Army private, Robert Maley, armed with a small box of dynamite, barricaded himself in his family's suburban Melvindale home. The youngster set off the dynamite, demolished the house, but miraculously escaped. As Police Lieutenant Frank Green related to WKNR News,
I no more than got out of the door. I still had my hand on the door, and I asked the officers that was standing on the stairs to leave the building and also to get the officers from in front of the place. And I had no more than got it out of my mouth when the blast went off.
Later, Maley, who was AWOL, said he did it all because he didn't want to go to Vietnam. In October, President Johnson embarked on a 17-day, six-nation tour of Asia. The trip, if nothing else, emphasized U.S. commitments to that area. The highlight of the president's trip, a visit to American troops at Cameron Bay. Our WKNR microphones were there.
I came here today for one good reason, simply because I just could not come to this part of the world and not come to see you.
Here at home, after some legal maneuvering, Dearborn's Mayor Orville Hubbard managed to get a Vietnam issue on the November ballot, the first such referendum in the nation. The voters rejected it, indicating favor for U.S. policy. But the mayor remained adamant.
It was absolutely wrong being over there. Can't win it. You can't win it militarily or otherwise. Not going to settle it. As de Gaulle said the other day, here it seems a shame of the people as powerful we are, as we are, going way over there with all of our power to bomb that country with our bombs and butcher those people off. It doesn't make sense anyway when I add it up, in my opinion.
Again in December, another holiday truce and charges and countercharges of violations. As 66 closed, 375,000 Americans were serving in Vietnam. There was no end in sight. ...1966 was an election year, and perhaps Michigan played the major role in a Republican resurgence.
The people have given us a mandate by their votes to continue our work for a better, more vital Michigan that will achieve total progress for all the people of this state.
George Romney, Mormon, former Otto executive, and a landslide winner to his third term as governor. The Republican road back in the state had begun when veteran Democratic Senator Patrick McNamara died in the spring. The governor appointed a Traverse City congressman, Robert Griffin, to fill the unexpired term. Griffin, a Detroiter by birth and son of a factory worker, had co-authored the Landrum-Griffin bill. This alone gave Democrats elation, for the act was unpopular among labor, mainly because it was misunderstood. Senator Griffin explained it. to the rank and file in the hallways of an AFL-CIO convention.
I want every opportunity to explain the Landrum-Griffin bill to the people of Michigan and to rank and file union members, because this is a bill in their interest.
A bill for it or against them?
It's a bill for them.
We got a different idea, Mr.
Well, I know that some of you have, different. And I'd like to have the opportunity to present the other side. And I think most union members would like to hear both sides.
A young and vigorous Detroit mayor, Jerome Patrick Kavanaugh, announced he would seek the Democratic Party's nomination for the Senate. He took on an old war horse, former six-term Governor G-Man and Williams. In the primary, Kavanaugh was clobbered.
I think we were all well aware of the fact that we were long-shot underdogs, but we wanted to give the people of our state a choice in this primary, and I think we gave them that choice.
The young mayor had picked the wrong time and the wrong place to fight the machine. With the primary victory, the Williams, Michigan magic was apparently again working well.
You ain't seen nothing yet!
As November neared, Governor Romney led what was dubbed the Action Team, campaigning mainly for young Senator Griffin. The governor did have an opponent, longtime Democratic worker Zoltan Ferency. In a Detroit Labor Day appearance, President Johnson's mispronunciation of Ferency's name, he called him Zoltan Ferency, did at least give the underdog some publicity. Later, New York Senator Robert Kennedy came to campaign. He was well aware of the president's faux pas.
And I'm very, very pleased to have an opportunity to support an old associate whose name is well known to us all, Zoltan. Ferency.
Zoltan Ferency probably never expected to win, but he never stopped working. And on November 8th, defeat was accepted graciously.
And I want to say that I pledge my personal cooperation and support to George Romney, and I congratulate him on his victory, and I intend to support every measure calculated to further the interests of the people of the state of Michigan, and give my support whenever I can in good conscience, and I know you will do the same.
As for Soapy Williams, the smile, the green polka dot bow tie, and the constant handshaking so successful in the past were not in with the times.
I'm proud of all of you, each and every one. And may the good Lord bless you and continue to give you strength in the faith that has sustained you up to now. Thanks a million.
Ladies and gentlemen, what you have just heard is more than the concession speech of the Democratic senatorial candidate. It is the passing of a political era in the state of Michigan. G-Men and Williams, known fondly as Soapy, in 20 years of active politicking, has never lost an election until tonight. Tonight he takes...
WKNR newsman George Hunter summed it up well as he reported live from Democratic headquarters. An era had ended. The Statler Hotel, where Republicans held forth, was in direct contrast to Democratic headquarters. There was gaiety and hoopla and victory. The eyes and ears of not only Michigan, but much of the nation focused on George Romney.
You did it!
And what you've done makes this a great day
for us and for the people of Michigan.
The Romney coattails proved both long and strong. He had, as he had hoped, carried many Republicans to victory, including Robert Griffin. But the big winner, George Romney, began searching for new ways to say he had made no decision as to 1968.
Well, I'm certainly highly complimented that so many people are talking about me in that connection, but I have made no decision in that connection.
I have not made a decision to become a candidate. And I expect to take a long, hard look before I decide whether or not I will be a candidate.
I don't see how any red-blooded American could be other than honored and pleased to have people feel the way these developments indicate.
I've frankly stated that I'm exploring the matter, and certainly any person ought to take a good, hard look at a question as important as this before making the decision?
I have not decided whether I will be a candidate, but only that I will take a long, hard look in arriving at a decision.
Elsewhere, the Republicans rebounded from the 64 disaster with a vengeance, picking up 47 seats in the House, gaining 3 in the Senate, and evening up the governorships at 25 each. Other political stars who began their orbits, an ex-actor turned politician, Ronald Reagan, who unseated Governor Pat Brown in California.
We can remember this November 8th as the day that we restored the two-party system.
In Illinois, Charles Percy ousted veteran Democratic Senator Paul Douglas in a campaign marked by personal tragedy. Percy's 21-year-old daughter, Valerie, had been murdered in the family's home. The campaign halted during a period of mourning, leading the victor to thank the man he defeated.
The generosity, the graciousness, and the great understanding that he showed last September is something that I shall never forget.
In Massachusetts, voters elected Edward Brooke as senator, the first Negro to take a Senate seat since Reconstruction days.
The people of this great state have answered all of the George Rockwells, have answered all of the people who would divide us and who would keep men from being brothers.
But the state of Georgia still had no governor as the year ended. The so-called wizened observers were still rehashing the whys of the GOP gains and Democratic losses. Blames were placed on many factors, not the least of which was the growing unpopularity of LBJ. And as for 68, the political pundits had begun taking pot shots at George Romney, surely proving he was the GOP's front runner. The Michigan legislature also felt the gains of the GOP. The House was equally divided. The Republicans controlled the Senate. But as in the past, the state seemed to have more than an average number of bad apples in the Lansing barrel. Among the worst, Detroit Senator Bernard O'Brien, convicted on a morals charge, accused by an MSU co-ed. He said he'll appeal, but his legislative career apparently ended. He did not win renomination. Senator Basil Brown of Highland Park, arrested twice on drunk driving charges, admitted he was an alcoholic, sold his car, turned in his driver's license, and then told WKNR News,
"I think the public should expect us to maintain ourselves in a fashion that shows the public trust is in good hands, but still recognize that we're all human, we all have some frailties."
Tax troubles also plagued politicians. Senator Brown, along with Representative James Bradley, charged with failure to pay back taxes. And a shock in Detroit when Councilman and former Mayor Louis Mariani faced a federal indictment for evading taxes. Mariani has not gone to trial. He remains a councilman. Later, a respected jurist, Recorder's Judge Arthur Kosinski, came under tax charges. The judge had neither filed returns nor paid taxes for 14 years. He settled and quietly resigned his position. As 1966 began, the fourth floor of the old county building was a busy place. A makeshift sign on a closed door stated, "Private, grand jury in session, keep out." One-man grand juror, Judge Edward Piggins, was in the fifth month of his probe when the year started. The grand jury had been appointed to investigate charges of ticket fixing in the sheriff's department. Early in January, Judge Piggins expanded, staging an overnight raid on the Grecian Gardens restaurant, a popular Detroit night spot, arresting owner Costa Kalakasidis and manager Peter Vitale, and confiscating what became known as the Little Black Book, reportedly containing the names of officials on the take. WKNR News questioned Judge Piggins on the widening of his investigation.
We originally started out with the alleged traffic ticket fixing scandal in the sheriff's office, and I believe perhaps the general public got the impression that that was the limitation of our jurisdiction, but it was not, and is not.
The grand juror also subpoenaed police records, raising speculation of a widespread purge in the department. But Judge Piggins denied inferences he was aiming at Police Commissioner Girardin.
Commissioner Girardin promised me complete cooperation, as he has done in the past. And I want to add again that I think Commissioner Girardin is a very fine public servant, a man of integrity, and a good police commissioner.
However, the rumor mill remained in high gear. There were reports of constant surveillance of police headquarters, continuing hints of some major indictments of important public figures. There were charges against police officers accused of taking bribes and bar owners for allegedly giving them. The department's ranks, already understaffed, were thinned further by resignations. Never, however, was that little black book actually linked with any of the officers who stepped down. Police Commissioner Girardin was kept busy defending his department.
Look, this is a tight McCarthyism. Do you remember how wild people were during his era about communism? All right, they're applying it now on a smaller scale, but just as deadly a scale.
In March, the Piggins probe returned to that ticket fix scandal.
Today, the grand jury issued indictments against the sheriff of Wayne County and the undersheriff for a violation of the law, which is generally known as willful neglect of duty.
Said Wayne County Sheriff Peter Buback.
Well, I am very shocked and amazed that Judge Piggins took the action it did. After all, I have 29 years of government service, and my integrity and character has never been questioned. And I'm quite sure that I'll be vindicated in due course in the courts.
As the one-year term of the Piggins investigation came to a close, a petition was filed for a new jury. When circuit judges met and voted, it was not Judge Edward S. Piggins, but Judge George Bowles who assumed the new jury duties.
Now that the bench has spoken through a majority of its members and granted the petition and selected me as their choice for grand juror, I intend to pursue the inquiry vigorously and with the assistance of the most capable staff of aides that can be assembled.
And, said Judge Piggins,
it's a little frustrating, you know, to get into the middle of an investigation like this and then suddenly be required to stop. Those who are in the wrong know they're in the wrong, and those who are in the wrong know that I know they're in the wrong. And yet my hands are tied at this moment. It's about like taking the axe out of the woodsman's hand when he's got the tree half chopped down.
By year's end, Judge Bowles' only action, charges against Garden City officials, including now-defeated Mayor Edwin Free, for misuse of public funds. Of those named in Wayne County grand jury action, there have been no trials, rather some dismissals and many lengthy examinations. If 1966 is remembered for nothing else, the black mark of mass murder is etched permanently on the pages of the year's history. In Chicago in July, the early morning quiet on that city's south side was shattered by screams. A young nurse had survived a night of horror. When police entered the apartment building, they found the bodies of 8 young student nurses stabbed or strangled. Cook County Coroner Andrew Tolman summed it up.
It was a crime of the century. It's one of the worst crimes I've ever seen since I've been coroner.
Within days, a one-time sailor and drifter, 24-year-old Richard Speck, was arrested and charged with the massacre. The University of Texas Library Tower overlooks the entire campus and most of the city of Austin. Today, that stately edifice is pockmarked, visible evidence of 16 senseless murders, all done by one young man. 24-year-old Charles Whitman had one mission, to kill. He did. Whitman had murdered his wife and mother, then methodically took an arsenal of weapons to the university tower and began firing expertly at those below, killing 13 total strangers, wounding more than 30 others, before his own life was ended by a policeman's bullet. Later, a brother of the demented youth told WKNR News,
he was on the honor roll and he was architectural engineering. He was an ex-Marine. He was the youngest Eagle Scout in the world at one time. He's never done anything wrong in his life, actually. That's about it.
On November 12th, a youngster walked into a beauty school in Mesa, Arizona, shot and killed 4 women and a 3-year-old youngster. 18-year-old Benjamin Smith was captured at the scene, led away laughing, saying he wanted attention. On February 12th, a world-renowned Jewish leader, Rabbi Morris Adler, was conducting a bar mitzvah at the Shaarei Tzedek Synagogue in suburban Southfield. Suddenly, the ecumenical services were interrupted. A horrified congregation watched as a young man shot the rabbi then turned the gun on himself. Within moments, an eyewitness told WKNR News...
The rabbi said, no, stay where... He said, don't come any further. I said, you know this man? He said, yes, I know him. I know him pretty well. And as he finished his talk, he walked over to the rabbi, and he was shaking his head, and he said, the rabbi, I'm sorry, and then he shot him twice. And then after that, pulled the trigger on himself.
4 days later, the gunman, 24-year-old Richard Wisniewski, died. He had been counseled by the rabbi for mental disturbances. Rabbi Adler died early in March. Murder was on the rise throughout the nation in 66, and in Detroit, some frightening statistics. 230 killings, the highest since 1929. Perhaps Homicide Inspector Albert Schwaller summarized it best.
I think their attitude toward these homicides would give the indication that possibly life is much cheaper today than what it has been, the value on one's life.
The nation's courtrooms provided dramatic new chapters in jurisprudence throughout the year. There were new rulings from the nation's highest court, including sweeping limitations on police in questioning criminal suspects. And the High Court ordered a new trial for Cleveland osteopath Sam Shepard. Shepard had spent 9 years in prison after conviction for the 1954 murder of his wife, Marilyn. In a second trial, he was acquitted. Late in the year, the Supreme Court said no to Jimmy Hoffa, refusing to review his conviction on jury tampering charges. The decision apparently paved the way to prison for the fiery Teamster Union president. In Detroit, loyal members of Hoffa's home local threatened a sympathy work stoppage that could have seriously curtailed the city's activities. Hoffa personally appealed in an impassioned Cobo Hall speech and again unleashed a verbal attack on the Justice Department. Our WKNR microphones were there.
They formed a squad known as the Hoffa Squad for the first time in the history of the United States, to where they delegated certain FBI representatives, certain stool pigeons with an undetermined amount of money to be able to follow me, harass me, wiretap me, room bug me, surveil me, steal my records, destroy my home if they could, and I refuse again to surrender.
Every year has its share of labor management disputes. Perhaps this past one set a new precedent. Public employee walkouts. In New York, subways ground to a halt as the new year started. Massive traffic jams followed. A judge issued an injunction. The union defied it. And Transport Workers President Mike Quill said,
the judge can drop dead in his black robes. We will not call off the strike.
Within the month, Quill himself was dead of a heart attack. A six-week strike against five major airlines proved costly in more ways than one. The settlement cracked the administration's wage guidelines. In Lansing, city workers walked out. City services were halted for a week. In Detroit, Ecorse and Warren, many residents watched garbage pile up as DPW workers struck. Detroit's strike was viewed by DPW Director Robert Toohey.
We collect from hospitals and from schools, from restaurants, and of course from private homes. And you can imagine the unsanitary situation and dangerous situation that will result if this sort of refuse is allowed to accumulate for any period of time.
All of the walkouts finally ended. One of the nation's newest labor leaders, the president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Jerry Wirth, was asked if Michigan was a prime target.
That sounds to me like something that was said by a mayor in a city in Michigan. It's not true. There have been strikes of public employees all over this country. We're not singling out Ohio or California or New York or Wisconsin.
In Pontiac, city police went on a sick call boycott. It lasted 2 days. And when the boycott ended, a full-fledged strike was threatened.
Unless the city expedites their demands with a realistic pay increase and their long-promised longevity plan, they will in fact strike, regardless of any penalties that they might be subjected to.
Pontiac Police Association President Herbert Cooley. The city and the police reached an agreement late in the year. There was no strike. And upcoming in the new year, UAW auto industry contract talks. Walter Reuther looked ahead for WKNR News.
Well, we haven't shaped our demands. All we want is equity.
We, the workers in General Motors and Ford and Chrysler and other segments of the UAW, all they ask for and all we will fight for is our equitable share of the increase in productivity that the labor of our members contributes towards.
1966 was also the year of the teacher strike. They started early in April and raged on into autumn.
The ridiculous idea of each of you individually crawling back on your hands and knees to beg the school board for your job back and to be placed somewhere on a salary schedule is absolutely ridiculous. Thank you.
The concentration of the walkouts was in Michigan. Teachers left the classrooms and walked picket lines. High school graduation ceremonies were threatened as the instructors demanded more pay, more say, fewer students, and less work. The suburb of Ecorse was a prime target. The teachers pulled out, saying they wouldn't be back without a contract and more money. The school board wasn't too impressed. They fired all 197 teachers. There was reaction.
If we don't have a contract here in September, there won't be any school. If they think they can hire 196 teachers, they have to be smoking opium.
This is a typical union-busting tactic that was familiar to any laborers in the 1930s and early 40s. The teachers' union now will stand strong as the UAW did in those days.
They're going to continue their regular strike activities.
After mediation, that dispute drew to a close. But there were others. Highland Park, Taylor Township, Riverview, Dearborn Heights, Wayne, the Crestwood District, and Hamtramck all had teacher picket lines. A new day of teacher militancy had arrived, and the school boards were less than enthusiastic about their newfound bedfellows. In September, the nation's first college teacher strike, occurring at the Henry Ford Community College just as fall term registration began. A professor, Dr. Archie Allen, led those strikers.
Well, I'm certain, as several of our people have said, that there are people throughout the country and certainly throughout the state that are watching what's happening here. And I think it will have an impact on higher education throughout the country.
The Dearborn Board of Education said they'd close down the college. The teachers suddenly rekindled their dedication to the art of education and went back to the classrooms, forfeiting a week's pay in the process. Detroit's Northern High School was racked by student protests in the spring. The students angered over censorship of a school paper editorial claiming they were being shortchanged in their education. A full-scale walkout followed, with students demanding the ouster of longtime Northern principal Arthur Carty. They wanted, they said, more study space, more recreational areas, and more stimulation. A kind of contraband school was set up at a nearby church. They called it a freedom school, with Negro history and civil rights the prime topics. One of the leaders of the student boycott, Michael Batchelor, was questioned by WKNR's Eric Smith.
We expect immediate action from the Board of Education. Either they'll down us or they'll uprise us.
Are you afraid they'll down you?
I am.
What will happen if they do?
We'll continue to stay out, I believe. The Board of Education, as we felt and as we've told other people, have not given us the consideration that we're looking for.
The Northern students received strong support from many sections. The boycott was finally resolved. Said school superintendent, Dr. Samuel Brownell.
Whatever I did, you could interpret as yielding to pressure, because I've been pressured to do everything. So whatever I did, you could interpret as being yielding to pressure.
Northern principal Arthur Carty was a man without a school, exiled to the board's downtown offices. Some said the action was a new day dawning on the troubled school system. Others more sensibly viewed it as a retreat and a concession to a new wave of anarchy developing across the land.
Ain't no question about it. We just got to organize and stop being ashamed and afraid to tell the man what's been on our mind for 400 years. Because black power is scaring the hell out of them, and we ain't even organized yet.
Stokely Carmichael, one of the new young lions in the civil rights movement. His call for black power touched off sharp controversy. The young militants took up the cry. The old line leaders denounced it, but tried to explain. Dr. Martin Luther King, in a Detroit appearance, was questioned by WKNR.
Very definitely, I don't see anything wrong with driving for power. It isn't a new word. I've been using it all along. Maybe I don't call it black power, but I call it power. I think the great problem that we face is that we are powerless.
In many cities, another summer of rioting. The worst hit Chicago, Cleveland, San Francisco, Atlanta. In Michigan, Benton Harbor, Muskegon, and Lansing. And on an August night on Detroit's Near East Side.
You're a train!
Fast, efficient work by the city's police quelled that outbreak before it could mushroom. There were arrests, but little bloodshed. The question remained, is the civil rights movement going forward or backward? No one seemed quite sure. There were disasters in 1966, in Wales, in the Far East, in Italy, in Turkey and Peru, thousands died. On storm-tossed Lake Huron, the ore carrier Daniel J. Morrell went down, taking 28 of 29 crewmen. Air crashes killed hundreds and made headlines. But buried in the day-to-day statistics of our revolving world, a mounting traffic death toll that neared 1,000 a week. In the Detroit area, no accident seemed as tragic as one just before Christmas, when a sand-loaded truck crashed into a school bus in Windsor. 8 of 30 children were killed. A frightened survivor spoke with WKNR.
Well, we were driving in the dump truck, all the sand came into the bus.
Did you get a lot of sand on you?
Yes.
Where was it? Was it in your face? Or...
Well, a little bit was in my mouth.
Did you just see the truck all of a sudden and then the sand came in?
No, I didn't see the truck.
Auto safety, a major news story of the year. A Connecticut attorney named Ralph Nader had published a book called Unsafe at Any Speed. The question, were cars as safe as they should be and could be? There were Washington hearings. Nader appeared, so did many others. The self-styled auto expert accused General Motors of prying into his personal life. The giant corporation admitted it, and there was a public apology from GM President James Roach.
As president of General Motors, I hold myself fully responsible for any action authorized or initiated by any officer of the corporation which may have had any bearing on the incidents related to our investigation of Mr. Nader.
When the hearings had ended, Congress rushed headlong into passage of an auto safety bill requiring certain federal standards for 68 model cars. The bill hit the industry where it hurts. And Henry Ford put it succinctly before WKNR microphones.
Many of these standards, these temporary standards, I think are unreasonable. I think they're arbitrary, and I think they're technically not feasible.
Mr. Ford even hinted application of some of the proposed standards could close down assembly lines. Earlier, the outspoken Ford Motor chairman had said if Ralph Nader was a technical expert, there was a job for him.
And he said some very interesting things here this morning. He even says that he doesn't think the rear axles are well engineered. Well, I say we got jobs for rear axle engineers, and if he's that good, we'll be happy to give him a job.
Nader continued to expound his layman's theories on how to run the auto industry. In a Detroit appearance, he talked with WKNR News.
Their collapse characteristics are very, very reminiscent of sardine cans. Seats are not moored properly.
Once during the year, Nader switched to the safety problems of oil and gas pipelines. That didn't stir much interest, so he went back to automobiles. By year's end, the industry agreed some standards could be met and some couldn't. The problem of traffic deaths remained, and the fatality lists grew. And it would seem some Americans could commit highway suicide driving an armored tank. It was a year of ups and downs and questions and theories as to the economy. A rash of price increases heightened the degree of inflation. Money was tight. Housing starts reached an all-time low. The cost of living continued to climb. Some housewives marched outside the supermarkets they usually marched into. Struggling American Motors took a bath, revealing losses of more than $12 million. A new board chairman took over, Robert B. Evans.
I think results have gotten by stimulation and new ideas, new inspirations from leadership.
Late in the year, there was unconfirmed talk of an AMC merger. Still, there was optimism. Chrysler's Lynn Townsend, newly named board chairman, told WKNR News,
"In our opinion, the fourth quarter of this year will be prosperous for the industry. Retail sales for the year should reach just over 9 million units, second only to the 1965 record."
Bank failures are not too common these days. Detroit had one in 66. The public bank went under, and the Bank of the Commonwealth took over the remaining assets. Commonwealth's president, George Miller, explained.
"We were able, through this transaction, to avoid, for all intents and purposes, the real closing of public bank. It did business as usual yesterday, and it is doing business as usual today. And that's pretty good, as far as I'm concerned."
Public stockholders were unhappy. A series of lawsuits were instigated, but there was no legal action. 66 had its economic problems, but as the new year began, the banners were still flying high. Americans began to accept space flights as somewhat routine. As we took giant steps toward the moon, the Gemini program was completed despite some cliffhangers. The accomplishments were many, including rendezvous between Gemini 6 and 7.
Gemini 6, away, Capcom, can you give me a status?
Yeah, we're in formation with 7. Everything is going here.
Roger, congratulations. Excellent.
Thank you, a lot of fun.
Later, our astronauts docked, walked in space. We even saw some close-up pictures of the lunar surface. And as the Apollo program gets underway, the moon gets closer to man every day. Other things happened in the skies in the past year.
Looked up and I saw as if someone had shot a skyrocket from downtown. I just saw the trail and it just blew up.
Well, we saw this big light, like, and we thought it was a meteor. We just started screaming. Everything was all lit up and...
Well, I don't know what I've seen. It's just a big orange ball was flying through the sky.
A huge meteor swept across much of the Midwest, frightening a few, fascinating many. Other strange phenomena appeared in the skies over Michigan.
A big light, all the light was, well, you can't say the shape of how round it was, but it was bright, where it was cut out like a hole. It was sort of silver gray. But you could tell it wasn't no, it got to be some kind of spaceship. Because you could see it still. We was close and I was 6 eyes looking at it.
Those annual visitors, UFOs. The Air Force acquiesced and sent astronomer Dr. J. Allen Hynek to investigate. He questioned and listened, and then on a Friday afternoon at the Detroit Press Club, calmly explained,
"This could have been due to the release of variable quantities of marsh gas. The disappearance of the light when people got close with flashlights or car lights would indicate that the glow seemed bright to dark, adapted eyes."
The theory wasn't exactly what everyone wanted to hear. It seems we would like to believe someone is out there watching. Some names passed from the scene during 1966. Ed Wynn, Admiral Chester Nimitz, Buster Keaton, Senators Patrick McNamara, Harry Byrd, and Theodore Green, Hedda Hopper, Elizabeth Arden, Sophie Tucker, Francis X. Bushman, Gertrude Berg, Billy Rose, Charlie Dressen, Bob Swift, and Tony Lima, Deems Taylor, Evelyn Waugh, Walt Disney, and the New York Herald Tribune. Another familiar name left public life, retiring to contemplate a long and controversial priesthood.
"I cannot fight time, I cannot fight age, and I cannot fight progress. And it's a decision in this sense that I really believe that I should have a few months, perhaps, in the beautiful fields around here."
Father Charles Coughlin of the Shrine of the Little Flower. The world of popular music spun along, and there were some different sounds.
Winchester Cathedral, you're bringing me down.
An unlikely recording star made a rather belated debut.
Down through the years, there have been men.
Detroit's Motown empire again kept the top spot.
I need love, love, to ease my mind. I need
Three young Detroit girls remained the Supremes. And there were mini skirts and the Monkees and topless waitresses and a host of now forgotten fads that accompany each year. There were many other events. Perhaps they deserve more than a passing mention. There was Brookdale Cemetery, where bereaved relatives found unmarked graves and in some cases found none. There was a Garden City day nursery where tuberculosis infected 14 youngsters. There was a lengthy and as yet unresolved dispute over the I-696 freeway and where it should go. Many suburbs had an answer. There were anxious moments in Homer, Michigan, when a train wreck periled that small community with poisonous gas. There were four unarmed hydrogen bombs that fell off the coast of Spain. There was a man named Herbert Aptecker, whose Wayne State and Michigan State speaking engagements touched off a campus free speech furor. There were other names, William Manchester and the book on an assassination, a dying Jack Ruby in Dallas. There was what may be an annual debate over the Warren Commission. There was a magazine named Ramparts. There was a short-term Miss Michigan named Gail Ann Chancy, who took the long way home and lost her crown. There was Sandy Koufax and an arthritic arm, Frank Robinson and the Baltimore Orioles, and Harry Gilmer and the one-sided snowball fight. There was the game of the century in East Lansing with no winner. There was Truman Capote and a lavish party financed by a book about some cold-blooded killings in Kansas. There were divorces and weddings and a couple of youngsters named Pat and Lucy who went, we are told, to live happily ever after in Texas. There's a good deal of 1966 many of us would prefer to forget. Perhaps we will. But a lot of what happens in one year goes on to the next. Vietnam, crime, controversy, and politics. They'll all be with us. It is to be hoped 1967 will produce more positive answers. At any rate, the new year is here, and we'll all have our opportunities. For WKNR News, this is Philip Nye.